We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
And away we go, episode 70 of the Al Galdi Podcast. It is Tuesday, May 25th, 2021. Yes, we have reached the age of 70, and we are in the midst of the day after the silencing of the cicadas in our area. No doubt you have heard the cicadas lately. How could you not have heard the cicadas lately? They have been everywhere, the brood X cicadas. They emerge every 17 years. We hadn't seen them since 2004, which interestingly, and I was thinking about this, was the year in which Phil Mickelson won his first major in golf. He then on Sunday, right, became the oldest winner of a major at the age of 50. So maybe Phil Mickelson is an undercover cicada. Anyway, the brood X cicadas have been everywhere. They're all over our driveway. They're probably all over wherever you live. And they, of course, do not shut up. That noise that they make had been nonstop until Monday, when it rained and cicadas were silenced, and it was wonderful. No fan of the rain, am I? But if it means shutting up the cicadas for a day, well, I think we can live with the rain. But hello and welcome. We had on Monday, I believe, a sign. I saw the sign, as Ace of Base once said. I saw a sign on Monday that the Ron Rivera culture change for the Washington football team is taking effect. I'm going to talk about this coming up next segment. We have on Tuesday a Washington OTA practice that is open to the media. Ron will be speaking via Zoom press conference on Tuesday morning, but it was on Monday that something emerged that I believe is reason to believe that the culture change is taking effect. Also, on this installment of the Al Galdi Podcast regarding the Washington football team, Julio Jones. There was a lot out there on Monday regarding Julio. Should Washington be in on Julio? Would Julio make sense for Washington? What, if anything, should Washington be willing to trade to the Atlanta Falcons for Julio? Why is Julio such a fun name to say? I don't know, and I'm not sure that I'll be able to answer that question, but I will answer those other questions in just a bit. Special guest on the show, John Press, founder of Japers Rink, which is a very prominent site about the Capitals, is the SB Nation site for the Caps. Now what? That's the question for the Caps, right? Now what? Where do they go from here? Where should they go from here off the 5-game first round series loss to the Boston Bruins. If you're a Caps fan, you don't want to miss my chat with John Press. We get into everything. Alex Ovechkin, Evgeny Kuznetsov, the goaltending situation, Peter Laviolette, and a lot more. I will talk Wizards, some interesting stuff from the Wiz on Monday off their game one loss at the Philadelphia 76ers on Sunday afternoon in the first round of the NBA playoffs. If you're like me and have been wondering why Daniel Gafford doesn't play more, Scott Brooks actually addressed that on Monday. And I'll talk Orioles, another painful loss for them on Monday night. Look, they are tanking, so it's actually good that they're losing these games. But geez, this team is finding new and creative ways to lose these days. 45-minute rain delay at the Minnesota Twins on Monday night. Then a monstrous two-run home run by DJ Stewart for a 3-2 lead. And then the bullpen gives up 6 runs in the bottom of the 8th inning. You can tweet me at Al Galdi. You can email me, the Al Galdi podcast at yahoo.com. I do continue to get a lot of feedback from you guys about the Caps having been eliminated in the first round of the Stanley Cup playoffs for a third consecutive season. Email from Jerry Moore. So foolish not to sign Trotz. Great decision, Ted. I tell you, man, it is incredible what has happened for each party since the Caps parted ways with Barry Trotz. The Caps allowing old Trotzy to leave the offseason after the Capitals won the Stanley Cup championship in 2018 is the ultimate you better be right decision. You know, the Caps had a benefit of the doubt at the time. They did have this assistant coach named Todd Reirden, who the Caps internally felt like was going to be a very good head coach. So you said to yourself, all right, look, this doesn't make a lot of sense, but there is a benefit of the doubt that the Caps get. We do see teams in the NHL change coaches all the time, even when those teams happen to be winning at times. So, all right, but you better be right on something like this. And more wrong, the Capitals could not have been. For the Caps, as we all know too well, 3 consecutive first-round exits in the Stanley Cup playoffs since the divorce with old Trotzy, including, right, these last 2 first-round exits, each coming in just 5 games. For Trotz and his new team, which I guess isn't so new anymore, the New York Islanders, advancement to at least the 2nd round of the Stanley Cup playoffs in each of the last 2 seasons. The Islanders made it to the Eastern Conference Final in last season's Stanley Cup playoffs, during which the Isles, of course, eliminated the Caps in the first round in 5 games. And now for the Islanders, a 3-2 lead on the Pittsburgh Penguins in the first round of this season's Stanley Cup playoffs. The Islanders on Monday night, in case you missed it, a 3-2 double overtime win at the Pens to take a 3-2 series lead. Not counting those Stanley Cup qualifier games from last season, the Caps over the last 3 seasons are just 5-12 in the Stanley Cup playoffs. Trotzy and the Islanders now, over the last 3 seasons, are 17-14 in the Stanley Cup playoffs. How about that as a Caps fan? Caps over the last 3 years, 5-12 in the Stanley Cup playoffs. Again, not counting the Stanley Cup qualifier games from last season. Trotzy and the Isles now over the last 3 seasons, 17-14 in the Stanley Cup playoffs without counting the Stanley Cup qualifier games. You look at that as a Caps fan, you hear that as a Caps fan, you digest that as a Caps fan. What do you think Ted Leonsis is thinking when he hears that? Because I can tell you what old Trotzy is thinking. He's doing the Kirk Cousins, how you like me now?
How do you like me now? How do you like me now?
Exactly. Thank you, Kirky. I have for you another rankings update for the Al Galdi podcast. A colossal surge in the latest rankings, up 24 spots. Yes, 24 spots to number 27 in the country in the latest rankings on Apple Podcasts in the U.S. football category. The rankings change constantly, but as I am taping this very early on Tuesday morning, that's where we're at. Up 24 spots to number 27 in the country. So thank you again for the continued support. Please, if you haven't already, subscribe to the podcast. Doing so costs you nothing and really helps out. Also, please give the podcast a 5-star rating. And if you have like 30 seconds, just write a 1-sentence review. Again, costs you nothing. And again, helps out the podcast a lot. And don't forget, if you would like to become a sponsor of the Al Galdi podcast, if you would like to advertise on the podcast, if you are, say, a doctor or a lawyer who wants to expand his or her practice, or you run a business that's getting back into the swing of things with the reopening of our country, email us the address, the Al Galdi podcast at yahoo.com. Let the power of the pod work for you. And speaking of power, Ah, yes. So Washington football team head coach Ron Rivera, the head coach in the coach-centric approach, the godfather of the family, the mafia, that is the WFT. Don Ron will be speaking on Tuesday, 10:30 a.m. Zoom press conference as the OTA practice portion of Washington's offseason is getting going. You know by now how we roll on this podcast. When the Don speaks, we listen. So we'll have for you a lot on Wednesday's podcast regarding what Ron had to say. But speaking of Washington beginning the OTA practice portion of the team's offseason, something came up on Monday that to me was impossible to ignore. I tweeted about it. It has to do with the C word. No, not that C word. Another C word. A word that has become very popular with Washington in recent years. Culture.
You know, the culture is actually damn good.
Yes, Bruce Allen. The culture. So let's set this up properly. The NFL's offseason program for the 2021 offseason has been a big to-do. The NFL Players Association has openly urged players to boycott in-person offseason workouts due to the perception that this past season, the 2020 season, which of course followed a 2020 offseason in which there were no OTA practices due to the COVID-19 pandemic, showed that voluntary OTA practices, which for years, of course, have essentially been voluntary in name only, weren't needed. As the NFLPA was negotiating with the NFL on the terms of the 2021 offseason program, multiple teams announced via the NFLPA that they would be boycotting in-person offseason workouts. Those teams included the New York Giants, the Super Bowl champion Tampa Bay Buccaneers, the Seattle Seahawks, the Detroit Lions, the Bill Belichick-coached New England Patriots, and the Denver Broncos. Now, one of the things that has really turned me off to all of those teams boycotting has been the blatant usage of the COVID-19 pandemic as an excuse for not showing up for in-person off-season workouts. It is one thing to say that the OTA practices don't necessarily lead to winning and unnecessarily expose players to injury risk. There's a conversation to be had about those things. It's another thing, though, to make it sound like the NFL is endangering players in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. This, to me, is the kind of fear-mongering regarding the pandemic that has been ridiculous and yet has been perpetuated by way too many, especially in the media. Take a listen, though, to a portion of the NFLPA statement released on behalf of Giants players in April. Quote, "We stand in solidarity with players across our league who are making informed decisions with the help of our union, both in light of the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic and what the data shows about the benefits to our overall health and safety," end quote. Ah, yes, the playing of the COVID-19 card. That, to me, is shameful. That, to me, is unnecessary, irresponsible fear-mongering for several reasons. Number one, the NFL successfully conducted a 2020 season during one of the peaks of the COVID-19 pandemic. Not a single NFL game was canceled. Not a single NFL player got seriously ill, as far as we know. There has been zero evidence of on-field transmission of COVID-19 in NFL games or practices. Number two, so successful was the NFL in its conducting of the 2020 season during the COVID-19 pandemic that the CDC, yes, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, published a scientific paper jointly authored with medical experts from the NFL and NFL Players Association detailing the efforts to complete the NFL's 2020 regular season and postseason without, once again, any canceled games due to COVID-19. And then number three, we are, of course, coming out of the pandemic and, in fact, have been for weeks now. So this notion of back in April of, I don't know, you know, pandemic's going on, got to be careful with this thing. Like, yeah, sure, you have to be careful. But the United States, as of last month, as of April, was administering COVID-19 vaccines to millions of people per day, to say nothing of where the country is now and will be in June. The pandemic is in its dying days and hopefully is never heard from again. You know, we'll see what happens with these variants, with the potential for booster shots for the vaccines, etc. But we're coming out of this thing if we're not out of this thing essentially already. All right, back to the topic at hand. Back to the lecture at hand, as the great Snoop Dogg said years ago. The NFL on May 6th announced its offseason program for this offseason. The program was not agreed to by the NFLPA, but the league was allowed to unilaterally implement the program as permitted by the collective bargaining agreement. This is another thing that cracks me up with the NFLPA. So the latest CBA came to be last offseason, right? It is for 2020 through 2030, was approved by the owners in February 2020, was ratified by the players in March 2020. And remember how the player ratification of the CBA came to be. The approval was narrow. It was done by a vote, and the players approved it by a vote of 1,019 for, 959 against. And this is the best part, about 500 players didn't even vote. That's why, to me, the NFLPA, when it whines and complains, and some of the gripes are valid, I'm not here to tell you that they're not, but like the NFLPA barks loudly, talks a big game, and then never backs it up with any action. The NFLPA gets walloped every time there's another round of CBA negotiations. And then when it comes time to do something as simple as vote on a CBA, 500 members of the NFLPA, 500 players, don't even take the time to vote. That's why it's very hard for me to sit here and be like, yeah, let me listen to all your concerns. 500 of your people couldn't even be bothered to vote on the latest CBA. Anyway, phase three of the NFL's voluntary 9-week offseason program in the 2021 offseason began on Monday. Phase three takes place from May 24th through June 18th, is 4 weeks in length. The rules for phase three include teams being able to conduct a total of 10 days of organized team practice activity, OTA practices. You're likely familiar with these. We've had them for years now. The OTA practices are technically voluntary, but we all know that they're more like voluntold. No live contact is permitted at OTA practices, but 7-on-7, 9-on-7, and 11-on-11 drills are permitted. Additionally, teams are allowed, as has been the case for years, to conduct one mandatory minicamp during phase three. And so all of this brings us to our team, the Washington football team. Washington on Monday reportedly had more than 80 players show up at the team's facility in Ashburn, Virginia, for the start of phase three of Washington's 2021 offseason program. Yes, you heard that right. More than 80 players. So let's think about this. In an offseason in which a number of teams via the NFLPA have openly announced boycotting in-person offseason workouts, Washington players not only have not done that, they have showed up for the start of the OTA practice portion of the offseason program, what is technically voluntary, in a major way. Again, more than 80 players showing up on Monday, per reports. This is validation of Ron Rivera's culture change having been implemented. And yes, it remains too early to tell if the culture change is working, i.e. translating into more wins. We have to see more than one season. But for me, it is impossible to look at all of this and not appreciate it, and also not think about something that went down with Washington just a few years ago. It happened late in Washington's 2018 season. Jay Gruden, after practice on December 6th, 2018, revealed something that drove me nuts. He revealed that there had been some griping and complaining by some Washington players over the previous 2 days about practice being too long and or hard. Quote, "I think our guys this time of year, you can imagine that when you have 63 guys out here practicing, there can be some griping and moaning going on here. We had pads on today for the first part of practice. We had to check out our new linemen, and people weren't happy about that. Yesterday, practice, they weren't happy. They just played on Monday night, but there's a lot of things we have to get done from an offensive standpoint," end quote. I remember when Jay said this, and I went crazy. I will never forget this reveal from Jay. I cannot tell you how much I hated this reveal from Jay. What Jay revealed made his players look so weak and so soft that they were complaining about practice. And I'm not trying to be Captain Tough Guy here, but come on. Washington was in the midst of a playoff push. As much as it may have felt like the team wasn't, the team was at the time. Washington had lost four of the team's last five games. Washington was getting set to start a guy at quarterback in Mark Sanchez, who hadn't started an NFL regular season game since November 26, 2015, and who had just signed with the team on November 19th, 2018. Also, Washington had just signed a new number two quarterback. And Josh Johnson, the previous day, remember this was a season in which Alex Smith broke his leg, then Colt McCoy broke his leg. So you were down to Mark Sanchez and Josh Johnson. Washington also was getting set to start third string guys at both guard spots. I don't know. Sounds to me like maybe some extra practice was needed. And yet these players were whining and complaining like a bunch of softies, like a bunch of sissies, like a bunch of pansies. You know, one of my favorite scenes from the movie The Godfather.
You can act like a man. What's the matter with you?
Exactly. That's what was needed in that moment. Someone like the Godfather, like the Don, to slap some toughness into these guys. But there was more to this reveal by Jay than just that the players had been complaining. It's that they felt comfortable complaining to Jay. Think about that. Do you think that Patriots players late in the 2018 season were openly complaining to Bill Belichick about practices being too long and or being too hard? What did it say about how players felt about Jay that they had no problem voicing these complaints late in a season in which the team was in playoff contention? And this reveal by Jay in multiple ways to me was a flashing neon sign of the culture wasn't good at the time. And oh, by the way, what ended up happening in Washington's next game, that game that Washington was preparing for with these practices that were supposedly too long and too hard? Washington got demolished. The team lost its fourth consecutive game, fell to 6-7, a 40-16 loss to the New York Giants at FedEx Field on Sunday afternoon, December 9th, 2018, in the infamous Mark Sanchez game. The result of the game perfectly reflected the preparation for the game. Look, I'm not here to say that all of Washington's culture problems are to be considered fixed due to more than 80 players showing up for the start of phase three of Washington's 2021 offseason program. But that's not nothing in the midst of an offseason in which, again, the NFLPA has been openly advocating for players to boycott in-person offseason workouts. And 80-plus players showing up on Monday contrasts so much with what went down with that fading 2018 Washington team under Jay. You take that snapshot from December 2018, you compare it with the snapshot from Monday, and it's two very different stories being told. The Ron Rivera era, at its core, is about the culture change that none other than Dan Snyder himself declared at Ron's introductory press conference. More than 80 players showing up on Monday is a sign that the culture change, maybe, just maybe, is working.
You know, the culture is actually damn good.
Exactly, Brucey. So we on Monday had multiple developments in the saga of Atlanta Falcons receiver Julio Jones. He is on the trading block, and we now know that he wants out and supposedly has wanted out for a while. So first of all, we had great television in Shannon Sharp of FS1's Undisputed calling Julio Jones on the air and asking him about his future. Jones didn't seem to know that he was on the air, but he said regarding his future with the Falcons, quote, "I'm out of there," end quote. Here's how this sounded. You'll hear the two guys featured on Undisputed, Shannon Sharp and Skip Bayless, and on the phone, Julio Jones, and we'll pick this up off him having answered the phone.
Julio!
I got you. This is your favorite uncle. What's going on, bro?
Man, nothing much. Got to go meet up with my brother. What's happening with you?
Man, look. You want to go to the Cowboys, Julio? Or you want to stay in Atlanta?
Oh, man. Nah, I'm out of there, man.
He's out of there. Are you going to... Ideally, where would you like to go?
Right now, I want to win.
Okay. Yeah. Well, don't go to Dallas. You ain't winning in Dallas, Julio.
You already know.
Okay.
All right, so on and on it goes. And like I said, I don't think that Julio Jones knew that he was on the air when he was saying those things. And that's a big no-no. But anyway, we got what we got. Julio Jones, quote, "I'm out of there," end quote. So he feels like he's about to be dealt. He certainly feels like his time with the Atlanta Falcons is coming to an end. Now, later in the day on Monday, NFL insider Albert Breer of SI.com and the MMQB tweeted that per sources, Jones, through his agent, approached the Falcons about them trading him back in March. So Jones, at least per the reporting of Breer, has wanted out from Atlanta for a while. We also on Monday, regarding Julio Jones, got a sense of what the asking price from the Falcons is. ESPN NFL insider Adam Schefter on Monday tweeted that teams that have inquired with the Falcons about trading for Jones have been told that the price is a first-round pick. Schefter also added that others around the league do not believe that the Falcons will ultimately get a first-round pick for Jones. And Schefter tweeted that the Falcons prefer not to trade Jones to an NFC team. Also, Breer, in a column that came out on Monday for SI.com, suggested that the trade compensation for Jones could be a second-round pick. The Falcons potentially trading Julio Jones really got going about a month ago, April 26, just 3 days before the start of the 2021 NFL draft, when NFL insider Ian Rappaport of NFL Network and NFL.com reported that the Falcons had been receiving trade calls on Jones. We really hadn't heard that much in recent weeks, and then we got what we got on Monday, an avalanche of developments in the Julio Jones saga. So, of course, we look at everything on this podcast when it comes to the NFL through a Washington football team prism. When it comes to should Washington be in on Julio Jones, I would say the following. The Washington football team should be in on Julio Jones if and only if each of the following standards is met, okay? I am going to set up very strict and specific parameters for Washington potentially trading for Julio Jones. Standard number one, the trade compensation for Julio Jones must include neither a first-round pick nor a second-round pick. I have no interest in Washington, with where the team is at right now, giving up a first round pick, even a second round pick for Julio Jones. If this is something you can do for a third round pick, okay, now I'm interested. But I'm not giving up a two, and I'm certainly not giving up a one for Julio Jones. Not with where he's at in his career, not for what he costs, even though the cost actually isn't that bad. That brings me to standard number two. I'm only interested in Washington trading for Julio Jones if Washington is very comfortable with Julio Jones contractually. This includes reasonable confidence that Jones isn't going to, like, pitch a fit over his contract, you know, demand an extension, demand more guaranteed money, etc., and that Washington is good with what is owed to Jones. So Julio Jones has 3 seasons left on his contract, actually has very reasonable base salaries moving forward. This upcoming season, 2021, $15.3 million. And then the next 2 years, 2022 and 2023, each season he has a base salary of $11.513 million. Those are pretty reasonable base salaries for a guy who's been one of the top receivers in the NFL for a decade. What is tricky, though, about Jones's contract is that the $15.3 million for the upcoming season is fully guaranteed, as are $2 million in 2022. So $17.3 million in guaranteed money remains on Julio's contract. So you got to understand that if you're trading for Julio Jones, you're giving up, in theory, a pick, and you're assuming, at the very least, $17.3 million in money, unless somehow the Falcons pick up some of that money. But remember, the reason the Falcons are trying to trade Julio Jones is that Atlanta is up against it when it comes to the salary cap. But standard number two is Washington has got to be very comfortable with where things are contractually with Julio Jones. And then standard number three for any potential serious interest for our Washington football team in trading for Julio Jones is Washington must be comfortable with Julio Jones medically. So the 2021 season is going to be Jones's age 32 season. He, in the 2020 season, played in just 9 games for the Falcons due to a lingering hamstring injury. That's a big red flag in terms of a receiver already in his 30s, a lot of mileage on the body, and now he had to deal with a lingering hamstring injury in his most recent season. But in fairness to Jones, he, over the previous 6 seasons, 2014 through 2019, played in 92 of a possible 96 regular season games. So he's actually been quite durable, but he wasn't durable last season. Like I said, older, lots of mileage. You better be sure, or at least be reasonably sure, that the body isn't falling apart here. So if you can't check each of these three boxes, A, the trade compensation for Jones includes neither a first-round pick nor a second-round pick, B, Washington is very comfortable with Julio Jones contractually, and C, Washington is very comfortable with Julio Jones medically, then no thank you. I'm not interested in Washington trading for Julio Jones. The only reason I'm even setting up these standards is that Julio Jones can still play. You know, Jones, over a six-season stretch, 2014 through 2019, never had fewer than 1,394 receiving yards in a season. Think about that. His worst season in terms of receiving yards over a six-season stretch was 1,394 yards. Another way of looking at that is like this. The single season record for receiving yards in Washington franchise history is Santana Moss's 1,483 yards in 2005. Julio Jones, three times in his career, has done better than 1,483 receiving yards in a season. 2014, 2015, and 2018. So the single season franchise record for receiving yardage for Washington, that has been eclipsed three times in the career of Julio Jones. And even last season, in which Jones only played in nine games, he still had a career best catch percentage, which is receptions divided by targets, of 75, and had a yards per catch of 15.1, which was his best yards per catch in three seasons. And consider this too, Julio Jones over the last three seasons in terms of yards per route run per Sports Info Solutions among receivers each with at least 50 targets has been top 10 in the NFL. 2018, number one was Jones in yards per route run. 2019, number five. 2020, number six. So he's still very good. He's still productive. He really is an all-time great. Like, I think he's a future Pro Football Hall of Famer. So heck yeah, I would be interested in Julio Jones from a Washington football team perspective, but I'm setting up very strict standards by which I would agree to a trade. Otherwise, no thank you. You know, he's Julio Jones. Washington would be foolish not to at least kick the tires. But if I'm Ron Rivera, I'm not overextending myself for Julio Jones. One, the trade compensation for Jones must include neither a first nor a second round pick. Two, Washington has to be very
Philip has just lost the respect of the youth league football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this. But Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error. Get the Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Comfortable with Jones contractually. Three, Washington has to be very comfortable with Jones medically. Otherwise, we ride with some version of what we already have at receiver. Terry McLaurin, Curtis Samuel, Adam Humphries, Cam Sims, Dyami Brown, Kelvin Harmon, Steven Sims, Antonio Gandy-Golden. You get the idea. The cupboard for Washington at receiver is not bare. Julio Jones for Washington would be an upgrade. He would be, though, a luxury, not a necessity. All right, guys, look, no one's perfect. Even the best baseball players strike out with the bases loaded. The best golfers sometimes three-putt with the tournament on the line. So if you feel like you come up short in the bedroom sometimes, it's perfectly okay. But if it's bothering you, there are options. Go to GetRoman.com/AlGaldy now. With Roman, you can get a free online evaluation and ongoing care for ED, all from the comfort and privacy of your home. A U.S. licensed healthcare professional will work with you to find the best treatment plan. If medication is appropriate, it ships to you free with two-day shipping. The whole process is straightforward and discreet. Getting started is simple. Just go to GetRoman.com/AlGaldy and complete an online visit. Take care of your ED without leaving home. Complete an online visit today to connect with a doctor and take care of it. Go to GetRoman.com/AlGaldy now to get $15 off your first month. Look, there's a straightforward way to take care of your ED. GetRoman.com/AlGaldy. Get started now to save $15 on your first month of treatment. So here we are again. The Capitals eliminated from the Stanley Cup playoffs after one round. Third consecutive season in which the Caps have been ousted in the first round of the playoffs. On Tuesday, Caps players will be speaking to reporters via Zoom in the final widespread media availability for Caps players this season. On Wednesday, Senior Vice President and General Manager Brian McClellan and Head Coach Peter Laviolette will be speaking to reporters via Zoom. What went wrong for the Caps in their five-game first-round series loss to the Boston Bruins? What should the Caps thinking be moving forward. Very pleased to welcome the Al Galdi podcast right now, John Press, the founder of Japers Rink, which has been a very popular site covering the Capitals for years, is the SB Nation site for the Caps. JP, it's great to talk to you again, man. The only other time we spoke was during the run to the 2018 Cup. A happier time indeed. How are you?
Yeah, that was a happier time. Maybe we should have gotten together a little earlier and get that juju going in the right direction. But I'm good. How are you?
Doing well. Appreciate you coming on very much. I guess let's start with this. So the Caps losing to the Bruins in just five games, was that more about things beyond the Caps' control, i.e. injuries / absences, the playoff format for this season, you know, the variance of the puck on ice in a series in which each of the first three games went to overtime? Or was the Caps losing to the Bruins in just five games more about things fundamentally wrong with the Caps in their roster?
I think it's sort of the totality of all of it. You know, they obviously were a very banged up team. You saw it down the stretch. Carlson, Ovechkin, Backstrom all missed games. I think Backstrom and Ovechkin got back for the last game of the season. Obviously, Kuznetsov and Samsonov missed games. Oshie missed games at the end. And quite frankly, you know, you look at Carlson in that series, you look at Backstrom, you look at Oshie in that series, those guys looked pretty banged up to me. I mean, they did not look like the players that they normally are. Not one of them scored an even strength goal in the series. Backstrom, second straight year, he's had, you know, just 1 point, one assist in five games in the playoffs. And then, you know, Kuznetsov was kind of a ghost once he finally got back in. And Samsonov, to his credit, hopped in and was great. Obviously there was the mistake in overtime, the miscommunication with Schultz that handed the Bruins that game. But otherwise, he was, better than I would have expected. But the reality was even a healthy Caps team was probably going to have some trouble with this Bruins team. I mean, the Bruins, ever since they got Taylor Hall at the trade deadline, they've been a totally different team. And their top six is just terrific. You know, they've got their Bergeron line and the Krejci line, and those guys really got it going, especially after maybe the second game or so. It looked like it was going to be a pretty tight series for a while there, but then the Bruins in overtime of game two really kind of pushed things in their favor, tilted the ice their way, and it never really was close in the underlying numbers after that. But Samsonov really gave the Caps a chance throughout the series, and as did Anderson. You know, what's crazy is that as one-sided as a lot of the numbers from this series are, the first three games of the series, Caps had leads in the second half of the game and just couldn't close them out. So, you know, they could have been up 3-0 conceivably, up 2-1. You know, instead they were down 1-2 and then kind of got blown out of the building in game four, even though that game was close too. So, you know, it's hockey, right? It's you can be the much better team and lose. You can be the inferior team and win. And unfortunately for the Caps, in this series, I think they were the inferior team and they lost.
So to you, what should be the approach moving forward? Are major changes needed, or should the Caps just stay the course because, like you just outlined, you know what? A few things are different, and the Caps are maybe leading the series. Maybe the Caps have already won the series.
Yeah, it's hard because on one hand, they were a good team at times during this regular season. With a couple weeks left in the season, they sure looked like they were they had it all together, and they were headed towards another division title. And if they had gotten that in the Islanders in first round, I think things would have been a little different. I think they matched up much better against the Islanders. They would have matched up better against the Penguins, frankly, than the Bruins. It was just a really tough draw for them, and you know, it was the injuries catching up to them. But these are also things that, as this core ages, you know, you have Backstrom at 34 and Ovechkin at 35 already, 36, I guess, by the time next season starts, assuming they sign him, of course. You've got Kuznetsov coming up on 30, TJ Oshie's 34. These guys, it's not like we can expect them to get healthier and more durable over time. So And it's basically at least a third straight year where they're kind of on the wrong trajectory to me. I mean, obviously they won the cup. That cup team wasn't as good as the team the year before or the year before that. Thank God they won it. I'm not ready to give it back or anything because they weren't the best team that they put on the ice. But, you know, after that, you come back next season and they win the division and they lose to Carolina in seven. Then they come back and they win the division and lose to the Islanders in five. Now they come back second in the division, out in five. So, you know, that trajectory is not really something that you're really happy to see. But the question is, what can they do, right? Because they've got this core. They've got Backstrom, Kuznetsov, Oshie, Carlson locked up for the next 4 years. You're going to sign Ovechkin, presumably, for something in the neighborhood of 4 or 5 years or whatever it is. And that's going to be like half of your cap in those handful of guys. So, you know, maybe you lose a Kuznetsov or an Oshie to expansion, if that's what you're thinking. Or maybe you try to move one of those guys, or maybe even Carlson or something. But, you know, the flexibility just isn't necessarily there in this roster because of the high-end guys and how much they've committed to them. So, you know, if I guess good news, if you like this team and thought they were just unlucky, you might have another bite at the apple with the same crew. But, you know, I think that Brian McClellan probably is going to try to be a little more creative than that in the offseason. So we'll see what happens.
Talking Capitals with John Press, founder of Japers Rink. So you mentioned Evgeny Kuznetsov. What do you think should be done about Kuznetsov? He is obviously so gifted. He was so good in that run of the 2018 Cup, but he drives you nuts. You had the multiple COVID-19 absences this season. You, of course, previously have had a cocaine controversy. He's been benched in the past. We know he's disappeared at times. What do you think the right approach should be? I know some people have talked about leave him exposed in the expansion draft. I don't know, man. Like, to me, it's like he's too talented to just let him walk away like that. But at the same time, he does drive you nuts as a Caps fan. What do you think the organizational approach to Kuznetsov should be?
Yeah, I mean, he does have the talent. I wouldn't expose him in expansion, I don't think. If you're fed up with him, then, you know, sell him off for 60 cents on the dollar or whatever you have to do at this point. If you are sure that this guy is not part of the solution but is part of the problem, you know, get something for him. Because guys of his talent, somebody will take a chance on that. And if you move him, you better have something ready for that second center position that the Caps forever, I mean, you and I know that was forever the problem until Kuznetsov arrived, yeah. Trying to figure out who's going to be a second line center, you know, whether it's going to be the Michael Nylander years and the Brooks-like tries, and the Eric Ferry even played center on the second line. You know, it was always just this revolving door of, you know, Eric Belanger types that just never really settled it. And then Kuznetsov emerged, and he really came through in 2018 and gave the Caps that 1-2 punch that that contending teams really need to have when you have, like, you know, your Malkin and Crosby, or you know, Stamkos, and the guys in Tampa or Vegas or Colorado. You know, you need centers. So, you know, if you're certain that Connor McMichael is that guy next year, which you know, I don't know that you could be that certain of something like that, you got to figure out how you're going to replace Kuznetsov. So, because just like with a coach, you know, it's easy to say get rid of this guy, but it's harder to say, okay, so how do we replace that guy? So, you know, if they think that Kuznetsov is more problem than solution, trade him. Figure out some return for him. I don't think that you can just let him walk for nothing.
You brought up goaltender earlier. As you think about what we saw this season from Ilya Samsonov and Vitek Vanacek, do you view either guy as a long-term answer at goaltender?
You know, I think that a guy like Vanacek, to me, his upside is sort of high-end backup goalie who can fill in at certain times for a stretch or whatever, like he did this year. But, you know, he's not a great goaltender. I don't think he has the upside that Samsonov has. Samsonov is in a lot of ways in the same boat as Kuznetsov, though, with the organization presumably being somewhat frustrated with how seriously and how professionally he is proven to be so far in his career. You know, but even before this year's two COVID absences, he was unavailable in the bubble last year after suffering an injury while off-roading in an ATV or something, you know, during the COVID break. So, you know, he's a guy who's been handed every opportunity. You know, the Caps let the arguably the greatest goalie in franchise history walk to hand the job to Samsonov, and all he's done is, you know, fumble those opportunities. So they can't be thrilled with him. I do think he's got upside, and potentially upside to be a number one guy. I think he needs to work on some things which aren't uncommon for a guy of his age, and maybe he's on the right trajectory. And most importantly, at this point, he's going to be cheap. So I think that if they can figure out a way to have like a come to Jesus moment with Samsonov about his behavior and his professionalism, then I think that he's an option, and he and Vanacek are an option as a duo going forward. That's not going to cost you a lot of money, because which is important, because they don't have a lot of money. They don't have a lot of cap room.
Samsonov is the most prominent of the Capitals' restricted free agents to be. Alex Ovechkin, of course, is the most significant of the unrestricted free agents to be. Is there any realistic scenario by which the Caps don't re-sign Ovi, or is this a fait accompli that he's going to be back?
Well, I mean, I don't see him walking or then letting him go, but, you know, until it's done, it's not done. I think that he's the most important player in the history of the franchise. He probably has a blank check waiting for him. But he also needs to understand that the number that he writes on that check is going to seriously impact this team's ability to be competitive during the life of that contract, right? Because, you know, if he goes for $11 million a year, you know, God bless him. I'm never going to fault the player for, you know, taking care of himself and his family and his future. But he's got to know that there's an opportunity cost there when it comes to the way they can construct a roster around him at that number. So I think he'll stay. My guess would be something in the 4 or 5 year range, and then maybe reassess how far he is away from the record. But and if the record's what's driving him, you know, forget about the team being competitive. They're not going to have enough players around him to be able to feed him pucks to get him that record. So, you know, I guess it'll come down to what his priorities and his needs are. But I would imagine that he's back. It's hard to imagine that he wouldn't be.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. With Ovechkin, as a Caps fan as you are, to what extent is it frustrating that the Caps have had this all-time great player, and yes, won a cup in 18, which we'll of course never forget, but every other postseason appearance has ended in a first or second round. Like, it's not even they haven't won a bunch of cups, it's that they haven't even made it past the second round more than the one time. And of course, that's something that's been an issue for the Capitals in their franchise history. Just three times, all time, has the team advanced past the second round. As a fan, like, how do you view that? Is that just one of those things that you say, all right, well, they got a cup, so that's what matters? Or are you kind of in the boat that I'm in, which is, it's great they got the cup, but geez, you really would like to have accomplished more here with an all-time great in Ovechkin and another, I think, future Hall of Famer in Nicklas Backstrom?
Yeah, I mean, I guess we'll look back on it and be somewhat disappointed if that's all there was. But, you know, for the first 40 years of the franchise, there wasn't even that. So and you and I were there for a lot of that. But so, you know, I guess it depends how you really consider the entertainment product that, that is hockey. I mean, this is a guy, in addition to the cup, that, you know, they had the best record in hockey for 3 years in the regular season. I think that should be valued more than people tend to value it. It's an 82-game season, and coming out on top there, it's not nothing. You know, European soccer leagues value that more than the postseason, you know, the regular season. They won tons of division titles. They won. He's led the league in scoring, in goal scoring, what, 9 times? Been the MVP a handful, small handful of times. So, you know, sure, they only got the one cup. That's, you know, more than a lot of guys will get. That's more than probably Joe Thornton will end up with, or lots of guys. I'm just thrilled he's off the list of greatest athletes of all time to never win a championship.
Yeah.
Because that would have, you know, that forever would have really stung. So, you know, yeah, it would have been great to do more, but of course it's not on him, not solely on him, at least. But he is the sort of the bulletproof vest for this organization, that that he just takes shot after shot after shot, regardless of other than 2018. You know, it's always Ovi coming up short, and you know, like I said, John Carlson, I don't think, has a goal since the cup run. Nick Backstrom has 2 assists in the last 2 playoffs. Where's everybody else? You know, Jake Vrana didn't have a goal in the last 2 playoffs, so they trade him for Anthony Mantha, who comes in and doesn't score a goal. So, you know, it is absolutely a team sport. Alex Ovechkin, more often than not, in those disappointments, has been the best player, or one of the very best players on the team. So, you know, yeah, disappointing, but look around. It's not just Alex, obviously.
Yeah, not at all. I mean, he's been about a point per game producer in his postseason career, though. The idea that he's come up small in the playoffs has always been way overblown. I actually thought he played well in this series against the Bruins.
Yeah.
Final moments here, and I appreciate your time so much. Where are you with Peter Laviolette? What did you make of the job he did this season? Do the Caps have the right guy as their head coach moving forward?
You know, I liked the Laviolette hire. I didn't necessarily love the Laviolette hire. And I thought, all things considered, he did a very good job in the regular season. It was a crazy year. No training camp, all the masking and all the COVID rules. They had a bit of a rough start for the first dozen or so games, and they got very good from mid-February through end of March, hit a little speed bump there, and then picked it up again. And I actually expected a little bit more from Laviolette in the playoffs, though. You know, one of the big concerns with Todd Reardon, it was his ability to coach in the playoffs, which just wasn't impressive. He had division-winning teams in the regular season. You can win a lot of games in the regular season just based on talent alone. But come playoff time, it really comes down to coaching and adjustments. And when you go through a series with Boston like this, where the first couple games you're right there, and then after that, your special teams, penalty kill and power play, both go in the toilet, and you suddenly can't break pucks out of your own zone or enter the opposing zone under control for scoring chances. All of that really speaks to coaching to an extent. So I'd be lying if I said I wasn't disappointed with what I saw there, but again, you know, this is a weird year, guy getting used to his team, maybe a normal, more normal offseason, everything. We can start evaluating him a little bit more. You know, whether he is or isn't the guy, he's the guy for now. So, let's hope he is. And, you know, I guess we'll maybe be talking about it again in a year, whether, they need to make a change there or something.
Well, I hope if we do, then they're in the midst of another cup run the next time we chat.
Yeah.
I appreciate you coming on so much, man. All the best. Continued success with Japer's Rink.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Game 2 for the Wizards at the Philadelphia 76ers in the first round of the NBA playoffs isn't until Wednesday night at 7, but there was some good stuff said by the Wizards on Monday that I wanted to get into with you. Wizards, of course, lost Game 1 at the 76ers on Sunday afternoon, 125-118 the final. Got scorched by Tobias Harris in Game 1. Harris in Game 1, 2 of 5 on threes, 13 of 24 on twos, 5 of 5 on free throws, finished with 37 points, 6 rebounds, 2 assists versus 2 turnovers and 2 steals. However, Tobias Harris's Game 1 really was a tale of two halves. The Wizards allowed Harris in the first half to score 28 points on 12 of 19 shooting, but the Wizards in the second half held Harris to 9 points on 3 of 10 shooting. When we talk about what Tobias Harris did against the Wiz in Game 1, it really was about what Tobias Harris did in the first half of Game 1. Head coach Scott Brooks on Monday on how the Wizards defended Tobias Harris in Game 1.
I think our defense on Tobias was obviously much better than that first, than the first half. I thought the first half we gave him a lot of comfort shots, a lot of comfort space. We didn't challenge his dribble. We didn't challenge his space. And I thought in the second half we did a better job. You can't take nothing away from him. He's a professional scorer, man. That guy, he scores all over the floor too. He can post up smaller players. He can take the bigger players off the dribble. He's pick and roll player, transition player, gets to the free throw line. I think the 28 points in the first half, especially, you know, the first, when the B got the second foul with 6.5 minutes to go or into the quarter. I mean, I thought he took over and kept them, you know, right around where they wanted to be. But I thought we were much better in the second half. We got to play 48 minutes of that.
Yeah, and that clearly has been an issue for the Wizards this season. The defense and playing defense for 48 minutes. It's one thing to do it for a quarter or two. Can you do it over the course of four quarters? Because if you do that, the Wizards have a shot to win some games in this series. I think that was made clear by the Wizards' performance in Game 1. Also from Brooks on Monday was him finally explaining why Daniel Gafford doesn't play more. So Gafford had a good Game 1, 12 points on 6-6 shooting, 6 rebounds, 2 assists versus no turnovers, and a team best plus minus rating of plus 14 in 20 minutes, 1 second off the bench. But why not more than 20 minutes, 1 second off the bench? I mean, you're a Wizards fan if you're listening to this. You tell me, when it comes to the Wizards three-headed center monster of Daniel Gafford, Robin Lopez, and Alex Len, which guy do you like the most? Which guy do you want to see the most of? And I know, Robin Lopez has been a lot of fun with his throwback game, the hook shots in the paint, etc. But Daniel Gafford offers a package of length and athleticism, the likes of which the Wizards really don't have much of. He's an exciting player. He's a young rising player. We want to see more of Daniel Gafford. Why haven't we seen more of Daniel Gafford? Why just 20 minutes, 1 second of playing time in Game 1? Why did Gafford in the regular season average just 17.8 minutes per game for the Wizards? It was Brooks on Monday.
Yeah, no, I mean, I like his minutes on the floor. You know, there's always other things to consider. And, you know, we have foul situations that we have to be aware of, foul trouble. And it's hard to play the way we play. And he's as athletic and as in great condition as any big in the league. But the pace that we play, he's still carrying around, I don't know what he exactly weighs, 260. That's a lot of weight to play, you know, 10, 12 minutes at a time. So we try to break it up as much as we can and the game flow, but his minutes on the floor has been really good, and his minutes are gaining good experience as well. So I think the more minutes he gets, I think the more things that he's going to be able to see instinctually. Right now, sometimes he's a little hesitant. We saw a bunch of clips with Embiid and with Howard that I think that he could do a better job with. One thing I love about Gaff, that he understands that he wants to get better, and he's very coachable. He listens to our veterans. He listens to our coaches, and he's a really, really talented young player that's going to continue to grow into a really good player.
All right, so now we at least do have a better sense of why Brooks doesn't play Gafford more, and I do think a lot of what we heard there makes sense. Gafford is a bigger guy. The Wizards play with a lot of pace. In fact, the Wizards in the regular season were number one in the NBA in pace, possessions per 48 minutes per NBA.com. No team played faster than the Wizards did, and so if you're looking at someone like Gafford, who, by the way, NBA.com lists as only weighing 234 pounds, but still, the gas tank can run low. With how the Wizards play. We also heard Brooks bring up how Gafford did against Joel Embiid. It was a mixed game one for the Wizards in terms of how they did against Joel Embiid. On the good side, Embiid went 0-3 on threes, finished with just 6 rebounds, committed 5 turnovers, and committed 4 fouls. On the other side, Embiid finished with 30 points, including 21 points in the second half, and the Wizards had a really hard time of defending Embiid without fouling him. He went 12-13 on free throws. Gafford, Lopez, and Len combined to commit 12 fouls in game one. It was interesting to me what Rui Hachimura had to say about all of this on Monday. Hachimura saying that the Wizards' double teams on Embiid in game one were too half-ass. That's a problem when you're facing a guy like Embiid. Here was Hachimura saying that on Monday.
I think just like if you're going to do it, you just got to go for it, you know. Last night we were kind of like, you know, just going half-assed, you know, and just like, you know, we kind of floating and stuff. So, you know, we just got to be more aggressive from the beginning.
You know, the truth is the Wizards' defense in game one wasn't terrible. And I know that's a low bar, right? But we're used to seeing the Wizards play terrible defense. I didn't think the defense was that bad on Sunday, especially as the game went on. I mean, you hated to see Tobias Harris go off the way that he did in the first half. You hated to see the Wizards foul Joel Embiid as much as the Wizards ended up fouling Embiid. But the Wizards overall defensively did a pretty good job. They just need to do a better job, and they can win a game or two, maybe more, in this series. I tell you what else, too. Going back to the three-headed center monster, you had a very efficient offensive game for Gafford, Lopez, and Len. Those three guys combined in game one, 30 points on 13-16 shooting and 11 rebounds. Don't forget, the 76ers finished the regular season second in the NBA in defensive rating, which is points allowed per 100 possessions per NBA.com. That you had that kind of offensive efficiency in game one against the Sixers when it came to Gafford, Lopez, and Len is no small accomplishment. And I know sometimes it's misleading to just add up what a bunch of guys at one position in the NBA do in a game because multiple people can be playing at the same time. But that was not the case in game one. If you look at what's out there in terms of the advanced box scores, Gafford, Lopez, and Len, no two of those three guys were ever on the floor at the same time in game one on Sunday afternoon. One more nugget from game one that I came across. So the Wizards in game one outscored the 76ers in the paint 76-58. In fact, the Wizards' 76 paint points in game one are the most points in the paint for a team in a playoff game since the NBA started tracking points in the paint in the 1996-97 season. How about that? No NBA team since the league started tracking paint points had scored more paint points than the Wizards 76 in game one on Sunday afternoon. The Wizards are such a bizarre team this season for so many reasons, but among them is in this 3-point laden era, the Wizards don't take a lot of threes, actually haven't been very good on threes, but have been exceptional on twos and have been great at scoring points in the paint. Obviously, Russell Westbrook has had a lot to do with that. But geez, 76 paint points in game one, the most ever in the NBA in the postseason in terms of since the league started tracking paint points, which wasn't until the 96-97 season. It is amazing that it took that long for the NBA to start tracking something like that. But the point here is the Wizards, as much of an underdog as they may be as an 8 seed facing a 1 seed in a first round series in the NBA playoffs, did quite a few things well in game one. And I'm not here to tell you the Wizards are going to win this series. I don't think that they are. But that was a competitive game one. That was a winnable game one. And there's no reason that the Wizards can't steal game two Wednesday evening in Philly. All right, no game for the Nationals on Monday. We did, though, have a game for the Orioles, and it was another loss. It's a good thing that the O's are tanking, because otherwise the trajectory of their season and the specifics of these losses would drive you nuts. An 8-3 loss at the Minnesota Twins on Monday night in game one of a 3-game series. 7th consecutive loss for the O's. The 14th loss in 16 games for the O's, who now are 17-30 on the season. And this was a game that the O's gave away. DJ Stewart, he was the Orioles starting left fielder and number 6 batter. A mammoth two-out, two-run homer to right field on the second pitch after a 45-minute rain delay for a 3-2 Orioles lead in the top of the eighth. That was some shot. That was a moonshot. The homer per Statcast went a projected 411 feet, featured a huge bat flip by Stewart. So a great moment for the Orioles. They're ahead, 3-2. And then comes the bottom of the eighth inning, in which three Orioles relievers, Tanner Scott, Cesar Valdez, and Tyler Wells, combined to allow six runs on a double, six singles, two walks, and a wild pitch.
Not very good.
No, that's not very good, Steve Spurrier. O's blow a 3-2 eighth inning lead. Lose again, 8-3, the final at the Twins, as the O's wasted another gem from John Means. Two runs in seven innings on five strikeouts versus five hits, which were two solo homers and three singles, and no walks. Means threw 63 of his 95 pitches for strikes. You know, he was not coming off a great outing, the 9-7 loss to the Tampa Bay Rays at Oriole Park at Camden Yards last Wednesday night. Means had, at best, his second worst start of this season. Four runs in six into third innings, but he was back to being really good on Monday night. John Means now over 10 starts this season, an ERA of 1.79, a whip, a 0.75. It is amazing, though. Means, of course, had the no-hitter earlier this season, that 6-0 win at the Seattle Mariners on May 5th. A tremendous game, tremendous performance. No hits, no walks, complete game shutout that featured 12 strikeouts. That win improved the O's to 15-16. Since then, the O's are 2-14.
Not very good.
No. That's not very good. Also for the O's on Monday night, another good game for Anthony Santander. He is the Orioles starting right fielder at number four batter. Had two doubles, a two-out RBI double in the top of the first and the leadoff double in the top of the sixth. Santander has been terrific since he got activated on Friday off the 10-day injured list. He'd been on that since April 21st due to a sprained left ankle. Santander, over the course of the Orioles' three-game sweep at the Nationals, 6-13 with a homer, two doubles, three singles, and a walk. And then on Monday night, Santander with two more doubles. Game two for the O's at the Twins. Tuesday night at 7:40, Dean Kramer versus Jose Berríos. All right, that will do it for you and me for now. Keep the feedback coming. You can tweet me at Al Galdi. You can email me, the Al Galdi podcast at yahoo.com. On Wednesday's installment of the podcast, Don Ron Speaks. I'll discuss and dissect what Ron Rivera said at his Tuesday morning Zoom press conference with the Washington football team beginning the OTA practice portion of the team's offseason. Again, a reported 80-plus players showing up on Monday. Also, a preview Wizards 76ers game two, which will take place in Philadelphia on Wednesday night at 7. Obviously, any realistic hope of the Wizards winning this series goes out the window if the Wiz lose game two, to whatever extent there exists realistic hope of the Wizards beating the Sixers in the first round of the NBA playoffs. But game two is essentially a must win for the Wiz. I'll talk Nationals on Wednesday's show. As Tuesday is Thursday. Game one of a three-game series against the Cincinnati Reds at Nationals Park is on Tuesday night. Max Scherzer is starting, and we'll see if the Orioles can actually win a game with their game two at the Minnesota Twins on Tuesday night. Have a great rest of your Tuesday. I'll talk to you on Wednesday.
You know, the culture is actually damn good.